Hi, thank you so much for coming in. Perhaps could you give us your name and the social housing community that you are speaking about or representing today?
My name is Imelda Doyle, and the housing community that I live with is Fold.
Thank you so much. And maybe to start off with, Imelda, could you tell us where is Fold?
Well, they have numerous accommodations, but I'm in one of the first they had in Dublin because they were originally an organisation from the north. And I'm at New Seskin Court in Talla in Dublin.
And how long have you been there?
I will be there 16 years in October.
Wow, fantastic. So maybe before we come back to Fold, maybe could you tell us, where were you born, Imelda?
I was born in Athy, County Kildare, at home in my mother's bed in 1944.
And did you spend time in Kildare?
I was brought up in Kildare. Unfortunately, which was a huge trauma for me, I only realised later in my life, I had to leave school at 14, so I just did a year in secondary school. But the biggest trauma was that I not only sang in my class choir, but I sang in the school choir. And I loved it. So that was it. So I moved to Dublin to live with my sister at 14, and I went to work in a factory where she was working.
At that time. And where in Dublin did you move to?
I moved to Rathmines. My sister had a bedsit in Rathmines. She took me in, and she worked for a company down on Aran Quay who produced Irish linen things, probably mainly for tourists. And her job was to design all these baskets of flowers and sprays and beautiful things. And she had her own little department, and she got me a job tracing. So my job, her designs would be perforated, and then my job was to put them down onto a pillowcase and trace very lightly so that the pattern came out. And then they went to a machinist, and she went with her machine. And what emerged was something beautiful. But I hated it.
But you're in Dublin.
I'm in Dublin.
Did you get married, may I ask?
I did get married, but much later, and only for a very brief period. It's unfortunate that sometimes we have to do something to find out that it doesn't really suit us.
So did you stay with your sister for long?
I'm trying to think now. I did stay with her for a good while. I wasn't doing very well. I found living in the city difficult. I had suffered from migraine from about the age of 8. And I was having a lot of headaches. And so eventually I left the job and I went home for a break. And so my mother took care of me. And then I got a job in a shop in Fairview. And that always feels like the real start of my working life, because I made friends with a couple of local girls who used to come into the shop, and we were great. Yeah, we never maintained our friendship over the years, but one of the girls, unfortunately, I don't know, but she got pregnant and she got married, but she lied to people. She said her baby was premature. But it wasn't. And I twigged then that she used to invite me up to her house when there was nobody in the house, and the boyfriend would be there and I'd be waiting in one room and they'd be off, no doubt, doing it in the other room. But that was kind of I always feel sad when I think about that. But I met her years later, her and her husband, the young man whom, of course, I knew at the time. And I met them at the races in Leopardstown one year. It was sometime in the 1980s. So that was a long way from the early 60s. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And she had her son with her and her mother-in-law, who was very old. And she just looked so completely different from me. It was like we'd come from two separate worlds, but we hadn't really. Anyway,
So that's you in Fairview. And did you stay around the north side for some time?
Where did I go after that? Now, I moved around a lot, so I hope you have time for all this before I get to social housing.
So are you private rental accommodation?
Oh, yes. Yeah. In Fairview, I was living at the back of the shop, actually. There was a house, and the woman who owned the shop owned that house, and I lived in that house with her. She also kept boarders, and unfortunately I was groomed and sexually abused by one of them. So, but again, you know, they were things that receded into, you know, but you're dragging them around until one day, you know, you crash and you have to start doing your own bit of archaeology.
So you left Fairview.
Yeah, where did I go after that? Oh, I know where I worked after that. I worked in a shop in Ballyfermot. There was a row of shops up beside the Gala Cinema, as Ballyfermot was then. There's a whole shopping area developed since in Lower Ballyfermot, but this was right up at the top near Cherry Orchard, and the Gala Cinema was there, and there was a chip shop. And then there was this shop, which was a big shop that had a counter around three sides of it. And I worked and lived over the shop with 1, 2, 3, 4 other girls. And I shared a room with Mr. Wan, who owned the shop. I'm still calling her Mr. Wan. I think her name was Rita. She lived above the shop as well. But every night she went out, and one of the girls who was the supervisor, probably unpaid, she closed the shop and we would retire upstairs. But they hated me.
So you didn't last long there then, did you?
I lasted a long time, considering how uncomfortable, not hugely uncomfortable, except I never felt part of them, you know. And see, I had lived in Dublin. I had my friends in Fairview. I had my sister still living in Dublin. So when I finished work at night, I went out. And they didn't. They all stayed in. Mm. And I think one of their favourite pastimes was talking about me. But they actually pulled a very nasty trick on me at one point. But yeah, they hated me. And then I left there and I shared a flat with my sister. My sister and I moved into a flat in Baggot Street. And I got a job working in a French delicatessen in Wicklow Street, which is no longer there, A la Francaise. Do you remember that?
Yes. Yeah.
And that was the first time that I felt any self-validation. Is that the right expression? I met a girl there and she thought I was great. And I thought she was great and we became great friends. Now, ultimately, over the years, we fell apart. But, yeah, but I can still remember her, you know, very clearly in my life. And what did I do next? I went to Scotland. A friend of my sister and mine was to come with me. We decided we were going to work in a hotel for the summer. And she backed out at the last minute. So I went up to Mallaig, up right up North Oban. Do you know that as well? And and I had an amazing affair with a very handsome Scottish art student. Freedom! And I came down to Glasgow. The hotel closed. And I came down to Glasgow. And for the winter, I worked with a Jewish family. And I'm often telling people these stories now about this Jewish woman, because I took care of her children and I did the day-to-day bits in the house, and then she had a cleaner who came in once a week to do the heavy lifting. But that woman was so kind to me. But her husband was a bastard. Sorry, you probably not have to delete that word. He was a real womanizer, you know, and I actually left because he made a move on me. And she was brokenhearted. And an interesting thing, She, in the house, everything was by the Jewish tradition. So you had to wash the meat dishes and the milk dishes separately. And there were certain rules around mm-hmm. food that have to be maintained. And I maintained those scrupulously for her. And she told me one day, she said, you know, I always love a Catholic girl in the house because they understand the importance of religion. But she had a clothes shop. And I said to her one day, but she had a clothes shop which kind of specialises in wedding outfits and mother the bride and blah, blah, blah. Well, that was my understanding. I'd never seen it. And I said to her one day, I want to go into town, I said, and buy myself a couple of dresses. I said, where would I go? And that night she came home with an armful of clothes. She said, there you go. And I said, well, I don't know which ones to pick. She said, have them all. So I left her and I went back then to work in Tunbury Hotel, which was, of course, the bee's knees. I mean, I was a lowly chambermaid, but I mean, if you said you worked in Tunbury, you could go to heaven and work for God. And that was just drinking and sex outside of work. There was a male staff house and a female staff house. But honest to God, I'd say at 12 o'clock at night, you'd be hard put to know which was which. And we had a communal recreation room. We were lunatics.
And this is in the 1960s?
This is in the 1960s. And so I was sex, drugs and rock and roll.
And how long did you stay there?
That closed in the winter as well at that time. So I probably stayed there for the summer season. Oh, yes, I did. And then they sent me to another hotel that stayed open up in Aberdeen because they wanted to keep me for the next year. But I couldn't stand it. It was so dull and it was so boring. And I was on my own. And this woman that was there managing it drove me mad. I probably, you know, I suppose I always felt about her that her attitude was that I was young and she wasn't. And how unfair was that? At the time, that was my feel of her. I probably called her a cranky old bitch to myself, you know. But, so I left there, and where did I go? I came home.
So you're back in Ireland.
I'm back in Ireland. It is 1966, and I'm having a madly sexual relationship with a handsome student, and I got pregnant. And I booked myself into St. Patrick's Home on the Navan Road because, hey, I got in there first. I'm not marrying you. I wasn't going to be on the back foot. And do you know something? I'd be hard pushed to tell you what I remember about being in there. I can't remember. I remember where we slept. I remember where we sat in the evenings chatting in various groups. I have no idea where we ate or what we ate or what I did all day. My sister said years later to me that she came to visit me one time and that I said to her I'd been ironing and she was thinking what an awful job that is for somebody who's pregnant because when I went in there I had to go in at 6 months and I've left out a bit there actually. I didn't, yes, I came straight home, but when I got pregnant, I went to a friend of mine that I'd met in Scotland, in Birmingham, and I worked in a hotel there. And, I really enjoyed that job in Birmingham, you know. The woman was a manageress. There was no kind of comment about the fact that I was pregnant and I wasn't married. Nobody ever asked me, did I have a husband? How did I get pregnant? You know, what horrible human being had molested me. And, you know, that was the kind of atmosphere, wasn't it, that you were taken advantage of. And I'm always at pains to say to people, nobody took advantage of me. I entered willingly into it all. But yes, I went into labour in 1966 in December. And that evening I was sent over to the hospital. They had a little hospital which was separate. And this woman, she wasn't a nun. Now, I was in my 20s, so when I say she was an older woman, like she could have been 30. But she looked, now on reflection, I'd say she was kind of 50-ish. She never spoke to me. She brought me into a room. She put me up on a narrow bed, very high narrow bed, to facilitate them, you know, rather than me. She walked out, switched off the light, and I remember listening to her footsteps receding away from me. And she left me there all night to have a baby on my own. And I was out of my body. I was on the ceiling, looking down at myself like a beached whale on this high table. And the next thing I remember was, get Sister Teresa, Sister Elizabeth. Sister Elizabeth was in charge of the hospital. So there's all this swishing of skirts and clicking the beads. Oh, Sister Teresa came down the corridor, flop, flop, flop. And the baby is born. But I remember that. I have no memory of that baby leaving my body. I have no memory of being in the last stages of labour. I'm looking at what I thought was a doll over lying over on a kind of a bench. It's my child, and she's dead. And, I'm writing a book about that at the moment, but I'm not focusing so much on that as I'm focusing on how I actually healed myself and got to where I am now, where I'm very content in my life and very proud of myself through the earlier sexual thing, the thing of leaving school. All that stuff, you know, had gathered up inside me. And I was a lunatic.
So you left St. Pat's then?
So I left St. Pat's, went home to my family for Christmas, who thought I was coming home from my job in England. And the manageress had said to me, when you've had your baby, come back and your job is there. So I went back and she said to me, I'm not giving you your old job back, she said. And of course I was, hello. She said, no, I want you to train for management on our team. She said, because I think you have that quality within you. So I started doing that, and my brother was in London and he dropped dead at work. He had a brain aneurysm that caused a hemorrhage. And I went down to London. My mother came over from Ireland and my brother came over. And of course, they had him on a support machine for a short while, but he was too damaged and he died. And I went to his funeral. I came home with my mother, and that was all really, you know. I mean, my parents were so distraught. He was my eldest brother. But I was like this. I only realised this years later. I was like this robot. Do you know, there was no feeling, there was no... But my own daughter had died just a few months earlier. And it was only about 5 years ago that I... you think I'm mad. Well, I got involved in yoga in my late 20s and I did loads of things around that kind of stuff. And I went to college. But anyway, I put a big sheet of paper along the wall. And every time I thought of something, I took a sheet of paper and I wrote on it or drew on it or just put marks on it and I stuck it onto it. And I said, there you are now. That's you. That's what you have to heal or get over or do something with. And it was a tiny little photograph of my brother who died stuck on the end of one A4 sheet. And I sat on the end of the bed and I looked at him. And suddenly I saw myself dressed the way I was at his funeral, roaring and screaming and absolutely just losing it. And I thought, that's what I've been holding on to. I never actually grieved him the way I never grieved my child. So I'm after going forward now a few years. Oh yes, when my son was born, I always made my own clothes because my mother made our clothes. And so when I was 9, I started sewing for my doll. And when I was 12, I made my first dress for myself. So all during my teenage years, when I wouldn't have had much money, I made my own clothes. I'd go into Brown Thomas's or somewhere expensive, try something on, have it in the fitting room. How did they do that? Oh, I see. Oh, no, that's not the way. That's a better way to finish that off. Because I saw that on another dress somewhere else. So I literally taught myself. And after my brother died, this is all jumbled all over the place. After my brother died, I went back to work in Birmingham. I came home for a holiday. And I never went back to work because I started having a nervous breakdown, what was called then a nervous breakdown. And I was in Lomans for 3 months. Would you believe I never told anybody in Lomans, or my sister didn't, that I had had a child that died at birth? Because that was the level of shame that was attached to it. I mean, it seems horrendous, but it doesn't seem horrendous to me now, because when I started writing to my book, I said to my son, whom I haven't got to yet, how would you feel, you know, if I got this book published, how would you feel if your friends read about this, you know, read about that this your mother did this? He said, fuck them, it's your life. He said, sure, write it. Write it for yourself first, and if you want to get it published then and you can, do it. Just go with the flow, which was wonderful. The father of my child, I actually met when I was in Lomans, because there was a very forward-thinking psychiatrist there, and he had an AA group of alcoholics in the hospital. Unfortunately, one of them was very handsome. And of course, he was separated from his wife. How did I know? You know, that I didn't know whether he left or she kicked him out. But anyway, I started a relationship with him. We went to live together. My mother nearly had a nervous breakdown. Got pregnant. Was offered the option of having Paul adopted. No way, Jose. So anyway, I left Paul's father when Paul was 4 months old. I got a check from the social welfare with a letter telling me that I had never claimed my maternity allowance for the time prior to the birth and after. And here was a check for £42 in 1969. It felt like the lotto. So I packed up the few things I'd left, and I rang him at work and I said, I won't be here when you come back. And that was it. And I told Paul, when he was 9, he asked me about him. Oh, I have the tissue here. He asked me about him. And I wouldn't badmouth a boy's father too. So I said, you know, he was a good man, which he was, and he came from a good family. But I said, he had a drinking problem. He said, would he be like me, Uncle Jack? That was my sister's husband. And I said, yes, sometimes. Oh, thank God we left. Not you left, but we left.
And all this time you're living in private accommodation.
Yeah.
Yes.
Never had. I was in my, it was 1980 before I bought my first home for myself.
And what home did you buy in 1980?
And no, it wasn't 1980 exactly. It was, would have been the early 80s. I bought an apartment down on Usher's Island.
And you were there for how long, did you?
I wasn't there for that long because I moved and I bought a house down in Wexford and a bigger house. I had gone to college in the 1980s and studied training and development, because one of the things I discovered about the particular brand of yoga that I studied is that people can actually change. People can change their lives. They can say, I don't want this life. I want to be a better person. I want a better life. I don't want to do this and I don't want to do that anymore. And that's what happened for me when I started practicing yoga. So it was a big shift in my life. And so I went to college. It was a total misstep for me. I should have gone to art college or the Grafton Academy. Because, well, just before I did that, with my yoga tutor, who was a man, an English man living in England, but he used to come to Ireland to teach. And we used to run courses in the summer, you know, personal development courses a week long. So you would come and you'd come from the bank, working in the bank, and we all from different places. So there was no inhibition to saying what was going on for them, because they were all concerned with improving their lives or themselves or whatever. But when you go into an organisation, even though people are biting their nails to the quick, they won't say, well, I'm very stressed in my job. So to me, I was just going through the motions.
So that's why, then you bought the house in Wexford. Is that you were changing your life then?
Yeah, well, yes, I stopped. Part of the reason I stopped, it was actually the 1990s before I left that house in Wexford, because in 1990, a car smacked into the back of me and I was waiting to turn right into a parking space, and I got a whiplash injury only on the right side, and the migraines, I got chronic migraine headache, and I got chronic everyday headache from taking over-the-counter medication, too much of it. And so I had to stop work. But by that time I had moved back to Dublin. I'd sold the house in Wexford and bought a house, small cottage in Clontarf, and I was living there, and I struggled on for a time, and then I thought, you know something, I actually had savings then, would you believe? Because I was very well paid doing the training and development. And I thought, you know, I'm going to take 3 months off, even if I spend all that savings, and I'm going to try and see what's behind this. And I had a friend who was a homeopath, and she used to keep saying to me, Imelda, that headache's trying to tell you something, you know, because the whiplash had recovered. The physical injury wasn't there anymore. But the neurologist said to me that I had a pain pattern in my brain and that she couldn't cure it. So she gave me sumatriptan, which is for migraines. But I mean, you're supposed to take 2 or 3 of those a month. I was taking one every day. And that was it. I never went back to work. I stopped taking the over-the-counter medication because it had codeine in it, which is addictive, and that was really difficult to do that. And eventually I had to sell my house, went and lived with my sister, and from there I ended up in Fold.
So you were in the cottage in Clontarf, and then you sold the cottage in Clontarf, then you were living with your sister, and then did you sign up for a housing list, or maybe could you talk to us of Fold came into your life?
Well, I was living with my sister, and then I'm not going to go into the whole story about my sister's life, and I have a nephew who has multiple disabilities. She's passed on since, but sorry, why did I say that? She's died. And but anyway, I said, we were down the country, so I said, look, I'm going back to Dublin. I don't like living in the country. I'm not comfortable where I'm living. So a friend of mine who had been a boyfriend but wasn't anymore, he said to me, come and stay with me. And I applied to South Dublin County Council on the advice of somebody who said to me, you will never be, because he lived in Blackrock, Tom lived in Blackrock, you will never be housed in Dunleary Ratdown. You will never be housed from the city centre where you are in Clontarf. But would you live in Talla or Fingal? I said, I'd live wherever if I had a roof over my head. So I applied to South Dublin County Council. They contacted me and told me that they had a unit coming up, especially for people over 55. And they would send somebody out to visit me, which they did. And a year later, I was in New Seskin Court.
And could you describe to me, what is your place like in
newsletter called.
Yes.
Well, the day I got the keys of it, I thought, thank you, universe. I thought, this is the universe looking after me. And the living room looks out over a rooftop garden. Now, unfortunately, we have a little problem there because there is a creche, and the children from the creche play in the garden. By 4 o'clock in the afternoon, that's so loud. They're so loud you can't hear yourself think, because it's kind of unorganized mayhem. And but apart from that, I walked in this lovely big window, full size of the room, looking out on this garden, looking across at other apartments. A friend came to visit me one evening for a meal, and she said, you know, this is what it's like when I visit my son in Amsterdam. And I have 2 bedrooms, a bathroom, a living room, a hot press, a store cupboard.
Kitchen.
My kitchen is joins my living room, which I like, because if you have somebody around, you can be cooking a meal and chatting. I just thought I'd died and gone to heaven. I thought it was the most wonderful thing that the universe had ever given me. I thought, this is it now. I can be sick. The headaches were so bad at that time that I was actually contemplating suicide, because I thought, I can't go on like this. And then I was a while there when my son said to me, my son moved down to Galway, him and his now wife, and he said, why don't you come down and live in Galway, ma'am? You'd be near us and, you know, we'd see you and whatever. And I thought, yeah, that's a great idea. I'd love to live in Galway. Yak, yak, yak. So, Fall don't have any housing in Galway. I did speak to my housing officer, Cathy Norris, at the time, who was extremely helpful, and thought I might apply to Clwyd. Clwyd have a transfer list, but they didn't have anything. And I walked into my living room one morning, because it faces the east. It was a glorious morning. This room was absolutely filled with sunlight. And I said, yeah, you're fucking lost it now, really. You're giving this up to move to where in Galway? The other thing about living in Talla, the cost of living is much less expensive than any place else. I mean, I get my hair cut for 30 euros in Talla. Where on the planet would you get your hair cut for 30 euros? And what a haircut. Like, it's not Mickey Mouse. It's not second standard, substandard. Everything in Talla is less expensive.
Gosh. Now, is it the whole, is your housing, like the apartment block, is it all fold, or are there different apartments in there?
No, the section that we're in, there's one section that we're in that belongs to fold. Actually, the 6th floor above us has a separate entrance, and that's privately owned. All the other apartments around us. It's my understanding, but I don't have this for a fact, that some of it, you know, would be owned by the council and it'd be social housing. And I don't know about the people upstairs. I mean, sometimes we bump into them, you know. But it was interesting once, because there's a door at the end of the corridor in our block that's kept locked. But at the other side of that door, there's the lift that goes to the 6th floor. And when we move in there first, like, if you left that door open, if you went out that door and left it open, you don't know who they are upstairs. Like, they're in social housing. What the fuck?
And you said you didn't see yourself in social housing.
I don't think about that. You know, yes. I mean, I know that I am, and that I'm reaping the benefits of it. And I know that my rent is very manageable for me on the pension I have. But I mean, I don't sit every day and think, oh, I'm in social housing. I'm just where I am. I mean, sometimes, you know, when neighbours have moaned, I have said to them, well, you know, you do realise you're in social housing. Yeah, but why can't it be this? Because you haven't got the money. That's why it can't be this, that and the other.
Sorry. No, don't be.
I'm going off on a little tangent now.
No, don't be, because it's not everything. But again, it's kind of just understanding the life of it. And I think it would be interesting because I don't think many people would think of entering into social housing when you're at post 55 as an age limit or things like that. It's a kind of a different kind of understanding of what's available or what different housing kind of...
Listen, when you have no place to live and you're living with your sister and then you're living with a friend, if somebody offers you a garden shed with a bed in it, you'll say hallelujah. That's my thing, you know. My thing is now that I am very blessed and very privileged to be living where I'm living. I don't know all my neighbours intimately, but I know some of them very well, and they're very good friends, and we all go to the Maldron for a drink on a Friday night. Well, a certain group of us. And and like Friday now, one of my neighbours that I'm very friendly with, herself and myself, because my brother died last year and he left me his car. Another brother, sorry, out of 9 of us, there's only 2 of us left, myself and my sister. But we headed off out to lunch, out in Kilcullen. Sure. You couldn't beat that with a big stick. Do you know, there's no... You see, I'll tell you what I am now, and I have never been this in my life. I am content. I don't use the word happy because I don't know what happy means. But contentment is a gift. But for me, the precursor of contentment is gratitude. Be grateful for what you have. Don't be sitting looking out the window. Oh, no, and I wish I lived here and I'd be looking out at the Stephen's Green Show. Wouldn't that be Marion Square? That's Marion Square. Wouldn't that be wonderful? Yeah. I mean, if I won lottery now, I'd go and live in the Shelburne and Stephen's Green would be in my garden. I mean, that is all just, that's all just fantasy, you know. Accepting the reality of where you are, no matter how bad it is. Because... I don't know if you've ever heard of a man called Parker Palmer. He's an American man. He does this work that he calls Courage and Renewal. He's written a number of books, but people in Ireland here, a couple of friends of mine actually do it, they run these Courage and Renewal workshops, and I've been to a couple of them. But his thing is hope is not a word, it's an action. And for me, hope is about seeing the possibilities, no matter how dire the situation. You know, people in Gaza have hope. People in Ukraine have hope. And we're sitting here perfectly happy. We're not in a war zone. We're blessed to live in a country like Ireland because older people are very well looked after. I had to give a man a lecture on that last week in the Maldron.
And is it a different kind of feeling, like if you had your cottage in Clontarf or you're thinking of your house in Wexford, is it a different kind of not worrying about it that you have in your place now?
Yeah. You know, if the slates blow off the roof, I just pick up the phone. If the water doesn't come out of the tap, I just pick up the phone. If I switch on the light and it doesn't come on, I check the fuse box and then I pick up the phone. Like there's no pressure for those kind of things. You're not having to pay property tax. You're not having to mind a property. And when I sold my house, I gave money to my son and my 2 granddaughters. And I said, that's it now. Spend that and you're done. You're not getting anything else. Because that's the reality, isn't it? I think, yeah, for me anyway, but I have been privileged as well that I've been able to do what you might call a lot of work on myself. With myself, and I still do a meditative movement on Zoom every Tuesday morning. I'm there on my own in my apartment, drawing shapes. But I am blessed and privileged to have been able to do that, and to have met people early, like in my late 20s, people that I would still know would be people I met through the yoga who are still working with, you know, these kinds of things, like the meditative movement I do is the five rhythms. It's particularly focused again on recognizing emotions and dealing with them. Yeah. Not right there at that moment, but see your therapist. Yeah, and I was blessed when all the stuff came up for me about my daughter, whom I called Rachel. So I found myself 50 years later telling my homeopath that that had happened to me. And then I told a woman that was in the Five Rhythms movement. I met her going to workshops, and she was a psychotherapist. And she just... I told her, and she said, that's a lovely story. How old's your granddaughter now? I said, 22. She said, yeah. She said, if that was happening to her and you were telling me about it, she said, how would you be telling me? I said, I'd be... She said, could we have a bed that for yourself, please? And that's what you need, you know. Yeah. So I've been blessed in my life. I have been blessed that I got my apartment so quickly through the council. I'm blessed that I'm with Fold. I feel I'm part of the tenant's engagement group. So I'm blessed to be able to do that as well.
And what kind of work does the tenant engagement group do for the community?
I'm here. But, well, we have meetings to discuss. Like, we had a very big meeting there. You touched on something there earlier, and I thought of it, where Koch, the CEO, was there. And it was about, you know, things that were needed by new Fold tenants moving in. And, like, simple things that you wouldn't think of. Like, I'd lived in an apartment, so I understood that storage heating system. But people moving in who've had traditional systems of heating don't understand that, or, you know, just silly things really like that. But so, yeah, so she was very she was very interested in all that, and she sent us out, you know, a feedback on the things that had been raised. So, yes, they're very engaged. They're not just throwing up properties and getting money.
And could you talk to us, how have you kind of made the apartment yours? Have you decorated it, or how
have
you?
Decorated it.
I can imagine. Can you tell us, how did you choose to decorate this space?
Well, the first time I've decorated it for a second time now, because I am there nearly 16 years. The first time I decorated it, was that wall was pink and that wall was turquoise. I was going into a bit of feng shui. If it's anything about developing yourself and spirituality, I'm in. But the last time, actually, my neighbour, a very nice Polish man who is an artist, but to make a living has worked as a painter, he painted my apartment for me. Now I paid him. And he did a beautiful job on it. He did it in a way that I would have never thought. So the walls are a paler grey than that, but between and the ceilings are white, and all along the top of the wall there's a band of white about that width. And he said to me, what about that light you have up there? That's a very bad light. And I said, is it? He said, yeah, you want something bright. So into Woody's with us, and this long light. And I said, no, that's too low. No, he said, I'll cut them chains. So he was just amazing. Then he came down one day, he said, I bought this for our bathroom, this mirror, but he said, my wife didn't like it, I had to get a different one. He said, would you like it? I said, I'd love it. So my apartment is, it's just great. I got rid of the sofa that I first bought when I moved in there, because when, God bless him, my beautiful brother got motor neuron disease, I went to live with him when he was dying. And I took a lovely sofa bed from his, I was sleeping on it when I was there, from his guest room. So it's shining new. And Chris put my television up on the wall for me, and
Have you ever celebrated Christmas there?
Yeah, all the time.
All the time?
Yeah. I celebrate everything there, and I invite mostly the women for Sunday lunch or for a night. You know, I'll cook and they'll bring the wine.
So, yeah, I have a nice group of friends there. Five women in particular.
And maybe when I'm speaking about these kind of special occasions, can you think of a memory of one of your first really special times you had in the place in Tala, here in this fold?
I think the special time that I would have had was that first Christmas after I moved in, because my sister and her late partner of 30 years, they always came to me for Christmas. As my sister-in-law said to me, home is wherever you are. So since my parents are gone, so we've no. So they would always come for Christmas, but they would always come, and like Bill would make the cheats chocolate pudding, and Liz would make the she'd make the mince meat for, and she'd come and make the mince pies, and we wouldn't have to have turkey and ham. I'd say, how about this? So we'd kind of plan it together before they came. And then on Christmas, that Christmas morning, Nancy was still alive. She was living down in Blessington. And we'd always go down to Nancy's for Christmas morning, and we'd have champagne and whatever edibles were going. Then, of course, we'd drive home full of champagne. Don't give my car. I had a car at that time as well. But so, yeah, so Christmas, in fact, Christmases have stopped being memorable since Nancy died, and since my sister's partner, she lives in Scotland now, since he died. Christmas just hasn't been the same. But that first Christmas there, it was like suddenly I had a home again, and it was like back to old times. Yeah.
Do you remember the first time your son came into your apartment in Tala?
Do I remember the first time Paul came? Do you know, I don't. Isn't that funny now?
Did you feel like you were looking very happy to show him that you're back on your feet?
Oh, yes. Yes, I was very happy to show him that I was.
He was very happy to see that I felt very secure and that I hadn't any issues around whether it was social housing or unsocial housing or heaven or hell or whatever it was. You know, no, I don't have any. I'm not consciously aware. Now, I have to tell you that when I heard it was in Tala, there was a bit of me that went. Don't say a word.